Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. This is Matthew Gage. This is lesson number 38 in the Gospel of John series, being John chapter 21, verses 1 through 25, the entire chapter. The title of the lesson is Lovest Thou Me? And if you happen to be keeping up with these, this is the last lesson in this series. Feel like I've really accomplished something. I know many people have taught through books in the Bible and such, and it's not that I haven't done series, but this probably is the most in-depth study and series that I have done, and it's challenged me. It's been a great blessing. I've learned a lot through it, both about the book of John and about putting together lessons, but I've greatly enjoyed this, and what I've done, I think I've spoke about early on, is basically these have been a series of lessons that I used in my Sunday school class. And now I go a little bit deeper in these because I teach a 7th and 8th grade Sunday school class. But we've taught through the entire book of John. In fact, just this past Sunday was when I taught this lesson, just in fact 2 days ago. So this is... been a lot of work, been a while, so I guess it's taken me about a year to wrap it up and get all the recording and everything done. And I'd say, you know, when you teach a Sunday school, there's also so many various times where you have special speakers for Sunday school or holidays where you know, do the Easter story or the Christmas story. So it's taken me a little while to get through there. Right at about a year, I believe. But anyway, I've greatly enjoyed this. I hope that those of you listening have. And one of the great things about doing recordings like this is that not only is it kind of spoken for the moment, it's spoken really for posterity. Because, you know, I don't know, as I'm sitting here recording this in June of 2010, you know, you may be listening to this years from now, you know, if my website holds on and if I keep it up, and even if, you know, perhaps maybe, you know, this just gets shared between people. So, but that's why I've done this, so I can help people, so I can be a help and a blessing to them, help some people to learn some things, learn their Bible a little bit better. And I know this hasn't been the most in-depth lesson or series, but I do believe I've hit the high points. And if you listen to all almost, I don't know, so we're going to be somewhere around 24 total hours of audio. If you make it through all that, without going crazy listening to me talk, I do believe that you will know the book of John very well. And that you'll know what it contains. You'll know a lot more about the ministry of Christ than you did before. At least I hope that you do. So, well, enough for the small talk. Let's get in here and let's wrap it up. We're going to close our study with what really amounts to what I'm going to call an anecdote about the resurrected Christ. Now, we know that Christ appeared many times. We have, of course, record here in the book of John about three of them. But in Luke and Matthew, I mean, there's many other accounts of him appearing. And even Paul speaks of him appearing different times that are not mentioned in the Gospels. So we know he appeared very many times. But this appearance of Christ takes up basically the whole chapter, and it's the one that we know the most about. You know, when we were covering Christ appearing to the disciples minus Thomas and then the disciples plus Thomas in the previous chapter, you know, it was just a span of 4 or 5 verses. Well, here we have basically an entire chapter devoted to this. Now, it is kind of interesting because as we wrapped up the previous lesson in John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31 are almost like John was wrapping up. And it's almost like this is just, you know, kind of the little extra thing thrown in there. You know, sometimes you'll read a book and it'll have an epilogue. You don't see that device used very often, but sometimes books will have that, which kind of tell the rest of the story, you know, what happens to the characters later on. I've read some history books that have done that way, where they tell the story, the historical story that they're telling, and then they include a little deal at the end just to say, you know, what happened to everybody after that, you know, through the rest of their lives. And this is kind of thrown in very similarly to that. It's just kind of an additional story. I don't want to speculate why it's there, because it really is. It's like John concluded his gospel in verses 30 and 31, and then said, "Oh, wait, I forgot something. Let me also include this as an added bonus feature." But nevertheless, it's there. It's supposed to be there. The Holy Spirit wanted it there. So it's there. God wants us to learn from this. And boy, is there some good stuff in this chapter. The setting of this is the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee, of course, is kind of in the northern part of Israel. Probably on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, to be exact. The region of Galilee is there. That's where the highest concentration of Jewish settlement was. So somewhere perhaps around the city of Tiberias or somewhere there on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. Now, the Sea of Galilee goes by many names. In fact, it's not called the Sea of Galilee here, but that's just the most common name. It's also called the Sea of Gennesaret. I hope I am pronouncing that right. And also the next one, Kinneret. I say Texas tongue does not do very well for some of these ancient and foreign words. But it's also called the Sea of Tiberias. And the reason why it was called that is basically, you know, you had a local ruler trying to make good with the new Roman emperor. And so what do? You name stuff after them. You know, just we do that nowadays. You name buildings after people and roads after people. Well, the local ruler decided, hey, you know what? I'm going to build a new city and call it Tiberias. And I'm going to go further than that. I'm going to rename that great big lake out there the Sea of Tiberias, so old Emperor Tiberius will like us more. So, did it work? Yeah, he actually did stay in power. So it actually did work. And the ruler that named the city named the city Tiberias and founded it was actually Herod Antipas, who was was one of the sons of Herod the Great. And I could not find that he was the one that named it the Sea of Tiberias. I believe it was. I'm pretty certain. I could not find that. It seems like everybody just ignores it. They just keep everything I looked at, whether it be on the internet or in books, just basically gloss over it's just called the Sea of Tiberias. They don't say who, but he actually did found the city of Tiberias and built it up as a capital for him. So it was kind of the major city in the region of Galilee. So anyway, that's where our story is going to be centered at. Now, I don't know exactly where this takes place, but it's going to be somewhere along the western, northern, northwestern shore of Galilee. Probably where Peter and James and John were from originally, though we're not really for certain. So we'll go ahead and jump into our story. Verse number one. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and on this wise showed he himself. There were together Simon Peter, and Thomas called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and two other of his disciples. So, we actually have seven of his disciples who have, I guess, give up on being apostles, and are going to go back to their old way of life. The problem is, that's not what God wanted them to do. God wanted them to preach the gospel, wanted them to help spread the word. But here they are just basically, you know, hey, Jesus is dead, rose from the dead. And, well, it's been fun, but I guess it's over now. So what do we do? Let's just go back to the way it was before. We'll go back fishing. So that's what they did. Peter's the ringleader, as we'll see in verse 3. But let's say there's seven different disciples here. We have Peter, Thomas, Nathaniel, James, and John, the sons of Zebedee, and then two other guys that John just decides not to mention, or maybe he forgot their names. I don't know. But there's at least seven guys here that that go fishing. And when we're talking fishing, let's go ahead and clear this up. We're not talking about rod and reels and casting your rattle trap out there trying to hook an 8-pound largemouth bass. You know, we're not talking about that. We're not talking about crappie fishing. We're not even talking about running a trot line. This is commercial fishing. This was how they made their living. And, of course, now there's two major bodies of water for fishing in Israel. One is the Dead Sea, and you can't fish in the Dead Sea. There's not any fish. It's too high of salinity in the water. I mean, there's just nothing there to catch. So the other is the Sea of Galilee on the northern end of the Jordan River. And this actually was where most of the fish from the area was caught. Fishing was very important. Fish was a staple for many, many people. In fact, they say if you read the writings of the ancient rabbis from this time, that they go into great detail and wax eloquent on fish and how to prepare it and how it's best to prepare it and such. So fishing was very important. And so what they would do is they would go out at night in their little boats. In fact, if you look this up, Google it or whatever, but look up Jesus boat. And there is a boat from this time period, the first century AD, that they were able to find almost intact that had sunk off the shore of the Sea of Galilee during the time of drought and the water went down. They found this boat. So you can actually see the type of boat that the disciples would have used. So you can look that up. It'll kind of help you with the mental image. It's there in a museum in Israel. So, but what they would do is they would go out at night and they would fish with their nets. They would go out, cast their nets out and bring the fish in. And in the morning they'd come back in early morning and they'd wash their nets out because it's very important. You had to keep your nets clean. Because they'll rot and stuff. And I mean, that's your life. That's your lifeline. You've got to make sure your nets and equipment are in good shape. So they would clean their nets and stuff, wipe all the junk off of them, make sure they're clean. And they would take their fish and haul them into town and sell them. And now there were enterprises where they would take them all the way to Jerusalem and sell them. So, this was a pretty, pretty well-run commercial enterprise that was going there. Now, how big operation did Peter and these disciples, were they involved in? It may not have been anything that big. It may have just been a little family business. But nevertheless, it was a good living. It was in demand. And as long as you caught fish, you could make some money at it. You know, not a rich life by any stretch, but you could make a good living. It was a very honorable trade and one that everybody really appreciated because everybody liked to eat fish at this time. It was great stuff. And that's something else you got to think about. In ancient times, they didn't have any type of refrigeration or anything. So basically, if you ate meat, whatever animal you harvested the meat from, you had to eat right then because there was not a good way to preserve it. So, if you slaughtered a cow, you had to eat the whole cow or you were going to waste the meat. And you just did not waste food back in these days. You know, they knew what famine was like. They knew what it was like to go to bed hungry. So eating something small like a fish, that was great because you could, buy one fish and that could be your meal once you filleted it and cooked it and stuff. That was your meal. So eating small animals like that was just great. So fish was a very good meat for the people to eat just for a lot of practical reasons. So, and it's culturally, it was something that they enjoyed. It was something that they liked to eat. So, it was a good life if you didn't mind fishing all night and smelling like fish. Verse number three, we'll get in and we're going to look at the miraculous catch here, which is very funny. This story to me is very funny because it really mirrors when Jesus originally called the disciples when he originally called Peter. because it was the same situation where they've been fishing, hadn't caught anything, and he tells them to throw the net on one more time, and they do it, and they catch more fish than they can haul in. The exact same thing happens. It's very interesting in that they don't realize that it's Jesus until it happens. They're like, oh, wait, deja vu. Wow, haven't we done this before? Oh, it must be Jesus over there. So it's very funny to me how this is a mirror image at the end of Christ's dealings with the disciples, direct dealings with disciples in his earthly ministry, it directly mirrors the beginning. So very interesting how it all kind of comes back full circle. Verse number 3, Simon Peter, always the ringleader, saith unto them, I go a-fishing. They say unto him, we also go with thee. So I said, hey, good idea, we'll go with you. They went forth and entered into a ship immediately, and that night they caught nothing. So I guess they had visions of making a living again. I think they were already spending their money. I mean, hey, the past 3.5 years or so, they probably have not had the time, had much time to make money. Now, I mean, some of them, including Peter, we know had a family to support. So, there's a lot of factors go involved with their decision here to kind of forsake the ministry and go back to trying to make a living. Now, it's not that, well, let's get this out of the way. It's not that the fact that they were going back into business and going back to their old jobs and trying to take care of their family, that's not the issue. God's plan is for man to take care of himself through work. Go to my website, BaptistBasics.org, and if you'll go to the sermons, I think this one was on the downloads page. I have one on the biblical philosophy of work that I preach and go through the entire Bible. Work is not bad. That's not what the disciples were in trouble for. What the disciples were in trouble for here is that they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing. They had a work to do, but it was a spiritual work, and they were the ones that had to do it. You know, no one else was trained for it. Christ himself had trained them to do the work of carrying on the gospel. So they had to be the ones to do it. They needed to be the ones that did it. So when they decided to go back to their old life, basically they were saying, you know, well, this has been fun, boys, and, you know, I've learned a lot, but, well, I guess it's over now. Let's just go back to the way things were. But things had changed. They had changed. And Christ has to appear to them to set them straight. So they go, and, of course, they go out, and they say they fish at night, and I don't know exactly the exact reasoning for that. I told my Sunday school classes because, you know, the fish couldn't see the nets, and, you know, because it was dark and they'd swim right into them. But no, but mainly it was just so in the morning they would have fresh catch to sell in the markets. Verse number 4. But when morning was now come, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples knew not that it was Jesus. Now this is something also very common here with the appearances of Christ after the resurrection, is that people did not recognize him. God evidently kind of withheld their understanding, and they don't recognize him right away. It's not that he looked different or disguised himself. I think just for the purpose of these people learning their lessons, God withheld their understanding for a little bit. I think that's kind of what he did with Mary also. Though, practically speaking, it could have been just because she was weeping so hard at the tomb. I think that he kind of withheld her understanding just so she could learn the lesson that she needed to learn. Verse number 5. Then Jesus said to them, children, have you any meat? They answered him, no. So Jesus asked them, not have you any meat, like, hey, can I buy something? Or what he's asking, do you have anything to eat? The word meat there, you can take to mean, you know, vittles. We use another good old-fashioned Texas term there. You know, it means food, okay? So it's like, look, hey, fellas, y'all got anything to eat? And they say, of course, no. Why? Because they've been out there all night, and they ain't caught nothing. You know, if they brought anything with them, they've probably already ate it because they've been working and they're tired and they're probably hungry themselves. So, if they had any food, if they had brought some beef jerky with them, they have already ate it. So they don't have any food. Verse number 6. And he said unto them, cast the net on the right side of the ship, and ye shall find. So, you know, what do? They obey. It's amazing. This is the second time they go through this where they go all night. The professional fishermen, they know what they're doing, and yet they didn't catch anything. So, I mean, if anybody's going to catch fish, it would be these guys. They know what they're doing. But here is just some guy standing on the shore says, hey, try one more time. Just throw it over there on the other side and see what happens. And they say, well, hey, it was worth a shot. So they cast, therefore, and now they were not able to draw it for the multitude of fishes. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, it ought to, because this happened before. And let's see. I believe it's let me double check this reference here. I believe it's in Luke chapter 5. I keep referencing it. So let me make sure that I am right about that. Yes. Thank you. Cross reference in the Scofield Bible. Talks about in Luke chapter 5, verse 1, it came to pass as the people pressed upon him to hear the word of God. He stood by the lake of Gennesaret and saw two ships standing by the lake, but the fishermen were gone out of them and were washing their nets. And he entered into one of the ships, which was Simon's, and prayed him that he would thrust out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the people out of the ship. Now when he had left speaking, he said unto Simon, launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a draught. And Simon answering said unto him, Master, we have toiled all the night and have taken nothing. Nevertheless, at thy word, I will let down the net. And when they had done had this done, they enclosed a great multitude of fishes, and their net brake. And they beckoned unto their partners, which were in the other ship, and that they should come and help them. And they came and filled both the ships so that they began to sink. So, and then keep on reading there. I just read through verse number 7. So, you know, that's when it happened before. And here we go, seeing the exact same storyline come about. They hadn't caught anything all night. But, okay, well, we'll try one more time. They throw down the net, and they catch more fish than they can handle. It's also very interesting, going back to Luke chapter 5, I have it underlined there. He said, let down your nets, plural. And Peter says, I'll let down a net. He didn't really obey. They probably could have caught more fish if it wasn't for his lack of faith. So here they go. They cast down the net, and there's so many fish, they could not get it into the boat. So, verse number 7, therefore the disciple whom Jesus loved, that is John, saith unto Peter, it is the Lord. So the light bulb clicks in John, and he says, wait, oh, deja vu, we've done this before. That's got to be Jesus over there. Now, when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he girt his fisher's coat unto him, for he was naked, and did cast himself into the sea. So, a little side note here, back in the Jewish customs. What was Peter doing out there naked? Well, I don't think he was naked. The Jewish clothing at the time, you had an undergarment that you would wear, and then you had an outer robe, which you usually called like a mantle in Old Testament terms. So it basically consisted of two different garments. Now, if you were working, what you would do is take your outer garment and, you know, wrap it around your waist, but you never took off the undergarment. So, they would do different things. They could tie it up, gird up your loins. That phrase, that's what that's talking about is, you know, tying your robe around and, you know, getting ready for action, you know, because you would actually kind of tie it up that way your feet would have free motion. So what I believe here, and I may be wrong, when we get to heaven, we'll find out I'm right. But what I believe is that Simon Peter had his coat off, had that mantle off, the outer robe, and that he was basically out there in his underwear, so to speak. He still had the undergarment on, because I said these guys have been out there working, and I think that's the case. He's been working hard, and he just took off his outer garment, which is permissible, not the best thing to do. Usually they would wrap it around their waist or something, from what I've read, but I don't think it was like he was out there with no clothes on. He still basically had his boxer shorts on, which actually the undergarments were a little more than that. But technically speaking, that was naked. You did not go into public like that. You did not, you know, go down to the market and buy lunch like that. So what did he do? He heard that. So he gets his fisher's coat and says he girded his fisher's coat about him. So he gets his coat, gets his outer garment back on, ties it around his waist, because then he's clothed. Then he's okay. Then he's decent. So it says then he casts himself into the sea. So because why would it make sense to put clothes on to jump in the water? You know, other than I guess you'll be a little modest when you get back to the shore. But what the case is, I believe, is he still has undergarment on and he just got his outer garment and put on. Verse number 8. And the other disciples came in a little ship, for they were not far from land, as it were 200 cubits, dragging the net with fishes. So Peter jumped ship and left the other guys to do the heavy lifting. They had to drag in the net with all those fishes. And 200 cubits, that works out, oh boy, I'll have to do the math again. A cubit is usually considered about 18 inches, so that would work out to be about 300 feet, about the length of a football field, about 100 yards there. Verse number 9, as soon as they were come to the land, they saw a fire of coals there, and fish laid thereon, and bread. That's funny, didn't Jesus ask them if they had any food? And they said no. Well, Jesus had food ready for them, kind of shows his care for them. It just even in a practical sense, because when they came there, you know, he'd already had the fire built and there was already fish there. Where'd Jesus get the fish? I don't know. He probably just said, hey, fish, I need some of you. And they just jumped out of the water. You know, I don't know. But it really, you know, the disciples been out there all night long, hadn't caught nothing. And there's Jesus and he's already caught fish. And so the fish were later on. So breakfast is cooking. Verse 10, Jesus saith unto them, bring of the fish which ye have now caught. So, verse number 11, Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of great fish. So, Simon Peter actually goes back to work now. And this is dropped land full of fishes, 153, and for all there were so many, yet was not the net broken. I like the level of detail here, and you can tell a fisherman wrote this. Why? Why would he have remembered some 60 years later how many fish there were? Only somebody with the heart of a fisherman would have remembered. We caught 153 fish. And not just little fish, but big fish. So it's a very interesting little point there. And there's some people that speculate what that means. I don't know. None of it makes sense to me, the explanation I've heard. All it is to me is, you had a fisherman writing the story, and he was so proud of what they caught that he left it in there. 153 big fish is what they caught. Which, when you think about, wow, you know, that's not a lot. You know, that you've seen the pictures on the Discovery Channel of you know, catching the salmon or the tuna and those great big ships and great big nets. But yeah, I think these weren't, you know, these nets that they had were not half a mile long. I mean, This was a bunch of fish, and even the strength of the line that the line and the cord that was used in making those nets wasn't very strong. So I mean, there is, you know, I don't know, there may be 400 or 500 pounds of fish here or more. I don't know exactly how big great would be, but I know I'm happy if I catch a bass is 2 or 3 pounds. So there's hundreds of pounds of fish here. So in a little net that really was not designed for that many fish, because they usually would just get them in a dozen or two at a time. But to get 153, yeah, that was something to be proud of. And John was proud of it and left that little detail for us. So verse number 12, Jesus saith unto them, come and dine. That's where we get the song, by the way. And now, and none of the disciples durst ask him, who art thou, knowing that it was the Lord? So it's like, oh yeah, it's obvious. We know who it is now. They don't even ask. Verse 13, Jesus then cometh and taketh bread and giveth them and fish likewise. So Jesus serves them breakfast. Verse 14, this is now the third time that Jesus showed himself to his disciples after that he was risen from the dead. I like the level of detail here John gives us in verse number 14. He says, this is the third time. Well, what are the other two times? Well, John told us what the other two times were. When Jesus appeared to the disciples without Thomas on the Sunday after the resurrection, And then the second time was, you know, about a week later when he appeared to the disciples with Thomas. Those are number one and number two. And this is number three. This is the third time that Jesus appeared to the disciples. So John goes into a lot of detail there and makes it very clear that the order of events with the after the resurrection. So this is going to launch us into the next section, which is a conversation between Peter and between Peter and Christ. Very, very famous. And I haven't dealt a lot with Greek and ancient languages and stuff, just where I've had to. And this passage is actually, it's very critical to understand this passage that we do this, because in this passage, there's some stuff that's just lost in translation. And we'll deal with that. I've titled this section "Love and Service," because what's at heart here is Jesus is asking Peter, you know, do you love me? And Peter says, yeah, I love you. And then he says, well, this is what you need to do. So three times he's going to do this. Why three times? Well, probably because Peter denied him three times. And it's very interesting. We're going to get into this, but it's very interesting. And even the words that are used there, because Peter never really jumps on board, even in this passage. So what am I jumping around here? Let me lay a little groundwork in this passage, okay? The word love in our Bibles, in our English Bible, in the King James Bible, can have more than one root in the Greek. There's actually two different words mainly that are translated. Now there's I think there is a third word that's used a couple of times. It's not very critical. There's a lot of words that are compound words, such as Philadelphia, brotherly love, that contain one of these roots. So when you see the word love in the Bible, it's usually one of these two roots. And I'll tell you what I did. I don't know anybody else I've seen do this, but I felt impressed after hearing a sermon on this. In the Bible I'm holding right now, in the Scofield Bible I've had, I guess I've had this Bible about 7-8 years or so, and really it's need to replace it. I just don't want to have to move my notes. In fact, I was going to replace it, and that's a different story. The Bible had a little accident. But what I did in this Bible is I actually got my Strong's Concordance, and I went through the entire New Testament, and every time the word love is used, I have the word love underlined, and in the margin, I have the Greek word that's there. Because it's very critical to understand some of these passages, which word is being used there. So I've jumped around it. Let me give you, there's two main words that are translated love. As I say, there's a third one that's not critical. I think it's in the book of Luke, and it talks about the Pharisees loving some kind of preeminence or the front row or something like that. I don't remember the exact passage. I can't think of it right now, but it's used like twice. So it's really not critical to know. You can look it up, get you a Strong's Concordance. But the two main words, the first one is phileo. In English, or Anglicanized, I guess, it would be P-H-I-L-E-O. If you look it up in your Strong's Concordance, it's number 5,368. And the Strong's definition of it is to be a friend, fond of, an individual or an object, i.e., have affection for. Now, Vine's expository dictionary, part of his definition says it's tender affection. J. Vernon McGee says it's friendship. Says it has to do with the affections and the emotions in human relations at its very best usage. So phileo is a very it's a very low form of love. Okay, it's the kind of love you know, between brothers, that is a good way to explain it. It's not deep love. It's not love you should have for God. It's really not love you should have for your wife. it's a very low form of love. Now, it's not to degrade it in any sense, but that's what it is. It's a low form of love. An easy way to think of it is I use the word like. Now, when me and my wife first began to kind of date each other, we kind of went through this progression, and yeah, it's silly. Most of dating is silly. People are silly in that stage. But one of the things we did, and I know many other Bible college type people that did this too, you don't want to jump in and say you love somebody. So there comes a point where instead of saying love, you just build into I like you. And it's just this very kind of mild form, but it's not love. So you hadn't taken the full plunge yet, because you don't want to say you love somebody until you're sure they're the one. So, but when you're pretty sure, you kind of throw this I like in there. So that's something we did. I know other people that have done that, and you may be sitting there right now laughing your head off because it's the silliest thing you've ever heard. But as I say, love gets silly at times. But when I think of the word phileo, I think of like. Okay, it's not as strong as love, but it does have a very good meaning to it. So, just for simplification, let's just say it is like. Now, the other Greek word that's used is agape. Now, J. Vernon McGee and a few other people try to split love into three different words. That there's agape and agapeo. Now, I'm not a Greek expert. I can barely read this stuff, and so I'm not the best one to be commenting on this. But basically, it's still the same root, so it's the same concept. So, but agape, if you want to look it up, it's Strong's number 26 in the Greek definitions. It means love, i.e., affection or benevolence. Sometimes it is translated charity, which, by the way, when you see that charity is love in action, so it's kind of more of a verb sense when it's done that way. So J. Vernon McGee describes it as, it is more than love in the emotion, it's love in the will. It is love that chooses its object. So this is deep love. This is love towards God. This is love towards your wife, okay? This is not just, you know, casual. This is something that is very deep. This is something that that has a deep effect on the person who does it. You know, you can like something or somebody and it doesn't really affect you, but if you love them, it affects you. These are the two levels here of love that we see in the Greek. So that's critical to understand in this passage. And there's a little bit other, I'm not going to get technically into the words. I don't have those in my notes, but there's some other stuff that's kind of hidden in there we'll get to also. So without further ado, let's jump right on into this very famous passage. Verse number 15. So when they had dined, Jesus saith to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? So the first question, we'll see that the same series takes place, the same order in the next three verses. The first thing is we see Christ's question. He says, lovest thou me more than these? So do you love me more than you love these? Now, what's the these? Probably the fish. I would say it was why he just basically give up on the ministry to go back to fishing. So I think he's kind of prodding him a little bit there, saying, do you really love me more than you love your fish that's been your livelihood? So, and the word that Jesus uses there for love is agape. So he said, do you deeply love me more than you love fish? Simon Peter's response, he saith unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. Now, love here is not agape. Love here is phileo. So Jesus says, do you love me? And Peter says, I like you. That's the difference in the levels of love there in the Greek word. Now, let's say in the English, it's kind of lost in translation there. But that's basically what Peter did. Peter says, yeah, I like you, Lord. Now, Jesus doesn't stop to correct him. He only gives him instructions. He saith unto him, feed my lambs, which means feed my lambs. It means feed the baby sheep. That's what that means in the Greek, okay? Very straightforward there. So We're going to see this exact same progression here. Jesus is going to ask a question. Peter's going to respond. And then Christ is going to give him instruction off of that again. Verse number 16. He saith unto him again the second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Now, once again, Christ is using the word agape. Do you deeply love me? Peter's response. He saith unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. What did Peter use? Phileo. It says, I like you. Jesus, so for the second time, the exact same thing takes place where Jesus says, do you love me? And Peter says, I like you. And then Christ gives him the exhortation at the end. Says, he said to him, feed my sheep. Now, this is interesting because this is actually different there. They say in the Greek, and I don't have the exact word, but the word feed there is actually means to shepherd, to tend, to care for. So as we're building up in this interrogation of Peter, we kind of see a growth in the command that Christ gives him at the end of it. It started out as feed the baby lambs, and now it is shepherd the sheep, adult sheep, not lambs, but sheep. So verse number 17, we'll see the third time in this series. Christ speaking, he saith unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Now this time, Jesus changes the word he uses. He does not use agape like he did in the previous two verses. He uses phileo. So he says, Simon, son of Jonas, do you like me? Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, lovest thou me? Now also that's phileo there also, by the way, in the Greek. So now Peter's upset. He's like, why has he asked me a third time? I'm getting tired of this. I've answered the question. So he's going to answer him. And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. The word love that Peter uses, once again, phileo. He says, you know that I like you. He never says that he loved Christ. Never said love as in agape. He always says phileo. He never would take that step. He never would agree with Christ. And you say, yes, yeah, Lord, I do, just like you said. No, he always says, I like you. Very interesting there. I don't know the full implication of that, but it's very interesting that the best Peter could do is just say, Lord, I like you. Now, listen, we ought to do more than that. We ought to love the Lord with all our heart, all our soul, all our spirit, all our strength. By the way, Jesus said that's, you know, the end of the law. That's the great commandment. That's, you know, if you can do that, you know, that is the law in a nutshell. Christ says two things. Number one is love the Lord God with all your heart, and the other is love your neighbor as yourself. So, but here we have Peter could not love Christ or could not speak loving Christ in the same deepness that Christ required of him. And listen, you know, we always fall short of what God requires of us. We do. I mean, no matter how hard we try, we still fall flat on our face. And notice here, Christ never calls him on it. Christ never condemns him. He says, okay, if you really like me, if you really love me, then you need to, get busy. And then Christ's final exhortation here says, Jesus saith unto him, feed my sheep, which means in the Greek, feed my sheep. It goes a progression. Christ's exhortation goes a progression from feeding the little lambs to tending the sheep to feeding the mature sheep. So there's a progression that's there also. This is very famous. There's many, many wonderful preachers that have done a fantastic job on dealing with this passage. Now, I'm not here right now to give you a great message out of it. I really just want to make sure I cover the ground so you understand what is taking place there. And for another time, another place down the road, maybe we'll do a sermon on it sometime. I'm sure if I keep preaching, I'll preach on it because I think every preacher I've ever heard for any length of time has preached on it or touched on it. It's very famous, and there's a lot of richness in that passage. So that's the interrogation that takes place between Christ and Peter. Verse number 18, Christ still speaking, verily, verily, I say unto thee, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself and walkest whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thine hands, and another shall gird thee and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. Okay. So what in the world is Jesus talking about? He starts out by saying, verily, verily, truly, truly. So it's like, this is the truth. This is going to happen. And basically, you know, let's kind of dissect the colorful language here. He tells them, look, you know, there was a time that you were free, that you could do what you wanted. You had, you know, your own strength, your own decisions. You could do what you wanted. You dressed yourself. You went where you wanted to go. You could do what you wanted to do. But it says, when you're old, you're going to stretch forth your hands, another shall gird thee and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. Now, that's not talking about being an old man and needing help. On the surface, it kind of appears that way, but let's look at verse number 19. This spake he, signifying by what death he should glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he saith unto him, follow me. Verse number 18 is actually talking about how Peter would die. Tradition tells us that Peter was crucified sometime in the mid-60s AD under the Emperor Nero. So why is that important to understand? Because that is what Christ is describing in the second part of that verse. Thou shalt stretch forth thy hands. What do they do on the cross? Their arms are stretched out. And another shall gird thee. So another person is going to be there taking care of you, tying you on the cross maybe, or you know, but there's going to be, you won't be able to do it. Somebody else is going to be doing it to you. And carry thee whither thou wouldest not. This means talking about being on the cross, that, you know, somebody else has a control over him. That's so what Christ is speaking about there in a very picturesque way. He's describing crucifixion. And John is quick to point that out in verse number 19. Because that's how, according to tradition, Peter died, that he was crucified. And tradition also tells us that he was crucified upside down by request because he felt he was unworthy to die in the same manner as his Lord. So he requested to be crucified upside down, which was, by accounts, even worse. If you can imagine how bad crucifixion would be, it was even worse to be crucified upside down. That was like one of the ultimate dishonors, was to be crucified upside down. Miss Varian says, and when he had spoken this, verse 19, he saith unto him, follow me. Peter still, even though Christ basically tells him, you're going to be crucified, says, follow me. But it was easy to be crucified because you were just following in the steps of Christ. You know, it's easy. It seems so easy. You read books like the Fox's Book of Martyrs. Seems so easy for those Christians to give their lives. Why? Because their Savior gave their life. You know, it ought to be easy for us to lay down our life. Now, hopefully, none of us will have to give our life as a martyr, but we ought to lay down our life as a willing sacrifice. That's what Romans chapter 12 talks about. Beseech you, therefore, brethren, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. That's what that's speaking about, is not that we should, you know, die, but that we should be dead to self, that we should be wholly offered to God. So when Christ looked down and said, follow me, well, there's a lot of depth to that, because Peter was going to follow Christ, not only in the ministry, not only in preaching the gospel, not only in his daily life, but he was going to follow Christ in even the method of death use. A lot of depth to those two verses right there. Then Peter is not going to take a chance to blow it. Now, I forgot to mention, too, verse 18, 19, Christ is telling about that. Now, John wrote this sometime very late. This very likely is 25 or so years later that John wrote this. So there's some details here that John's giving, like everybody, either other people didn't know or there's misconceptions about. And this that was probably something that the disciples knew but did not want to make public. That, you know, they kind of knew what Jesus had prophesied, but they didn't want to make it public. Hey, everybody, look, hey, you know, see Peter? Yeah, he's going to be crucified one of these days. You know, that's not something you want to tell everybody. So, but now that it's time has passed and he has been crucified, that they are willing to be open about it. But let's say verse number 20, Peter's not going to take a chance not to stick his foot in his mouth, even though he's already done it in verses 15 through 17. Verse number 20, then Peter, turning about, seeth the disciple whom Jesus loved, that's John, following, which also leaned on his breast at supper, so even more detail saying that that is John, and said, Lord, which is he that betrayeth thee? So, you know, he's very specific about who this is. It's the disciple Jesus loved. He's a guy that leaned on the breast on Jesus' breast at supper, and it's also the guy that said, Lord, which is he that betrayeth thee? So three things there say it was John. Verse 21, Peter, seeing him, saith to Jesus, Lord, and what shall this man do? So Peter, I guess, was feeling the heat and wanted to pass the buck a little bit and get some of the spotlight off himself. Says, that's nice, Jesus. Well, what about John? What's John supposed to do? Well, you know, it's really none of our business what other people are supposed to do. Now, I guess if you're a leader and you've got some followers, it becomes a little bit of your business. But in the end, you can't make decisions for them. You can't make them more spiritual than they want to be. You can't lead them farther than they want to go. So in the end, it's an individual choice. And Peter here was trying to get into somebody else's business. Verse 22, Jesus saith unto him, If I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? Follow thou me. So Peter, it doesn't matter. Yeah, you're going to be crucified, but if he lives until I come back, what does that matter to you? You take care of your will, the will of God for your life. Don't worry about somebody else's. You know, we got too many people that try to run everybody else's life. We got people that try to micromanage everybody else's Christian walk. But that is not the way Christianity is supposed to be. We need to focus on ourselves. What did Jesus say when talking about, you know, says that, you know, says you need to cast the beam from your own eye before you start worrying about the mote, the little splinter that's in somebody else's eye. He's talking to the Pharisees there, but good night. We can apply that to the Christians too. You know, well, it doesn't matter about us. I'm not in the ministry, so the rules don't apply to me differently. No, you're a Christian. You still have a higher standard for your life. So don't look back and think, well, this doesn't apply to me. No, you're still a Christian. You still have a high standard placed upon your life that you're supposed to live up to. So, and don't go throwing rocks at people because they might throw them back. And you've got as many windows to break as they do, because we all have feet of clay. We all have areas of our life that are not what they're supposed to be. And Jesus said, judge not and be not judged. So we need to focus on worry about our own selves, worry about what we can control, and quit worrying about everybody else. It's amazing how many, let's illustrate this way. Take this thought this way. It's amazing how many armchair quarterbacks there are. You know, in fact, there's TV networks that devote 24 hours in a day to it. All the ESPN, ESPN2, you know, Fox Sports, and you know, there's all these sports channels, and basically all they do is sit around and, oh, well, yeah, they tell you the news and highlights and stuff, but they also sit back and say, well, he made a mistake here. He shouldn't have pinch hit this guy at this point in the baseball game. Or, boy, if they had just run a pass play instead of a running play, they would have scored a touchdown. And all they do is play armchair quarterback and critique and worry about stuff they can't fix. Or they'll even speculate, well, if the Cowboys have a chance to win this football game, they have got to play good defense. Well, they might win the ball game and play lousy defense. You know, but they all speculate like they're, you know, these experts, these commentators. And it's really funny, and a lot of people have a good time with that, making fun of them. But, you know, we have the same thing, Christianity. We look back and say, well, you know, boy, somebody with that much money, they ought to give a little more to missions. You know, somebody, you know, boy, if I was them, I sure wouldn't go there. If I was them, boy, I would sure use my talent a little more for God. You know, at the end of the day, it ain't our business. It's a full-time job taking care of ourselves. Now, that doesn't mean we don't try to help people, and especially as a leader. If you're a pastor in a church, a youth pastor, a Sunday school teacher, it doesn't mean you try to help those people that are under your authority. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying you need to watch who you're throwing stones at, because you've got plenty of faults yourself you need to work on. Peter right here, he says, hey, what about John? It wasn't any of his business what was going to happen with John. He needed to stick to his own problems. And, you know, poor Peter had plenty of them. Now, verse 22, when Jesus was rebuking Peter, he says, if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? So it says, well, what if I want him to be alive till I come back, then, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, what does that matter to you? Verse 23, evidently there was some confusion brought about by this verse. Then went this saying abroad among the brethren that that disciple, John, should not die. Yet Jesus said not unto him, he shall not die, but if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? So evidently there was a misconception going around that John wasn't going to die. That John was going to be alive when Christ returned, that he was immortal because of what was said in verse number 22. And John is very careful to say that's not what Jesus said. Jesus didn't say, I'm not going to die. Jesus just said, if that's what I want, you know, it doesn't matter to you. So that if is a very important word there. That's not a declarative statement. It's just a possibility. It's an illustration that Christ is making. So that's what it's saying there. So evidently at the time there was a miscarriage. And it's very logical and understandable that they would, because all the other disciples were dead. And John was the only one still hanging around. And I mean, he's 80, 90 years old by this time, and everybody else has died. And in fact, everybody else died a martyr's death. The only one that it appears died of natural causes was John. And it's not that they didn't try. Tradition says that they boiled him in oil, that they tried to kill him, yet he did not die. So evidently there was some proof that maybe he wasn't going to die. So, but John is very quick to do away with those rumors and try to clear up that misunderstanding. Now we're going to wrap up the chapter with the grand epilogue to the book of John. And it's verse 25 is one of my favorite verses in the entire Bible. Verse number 24, this is the disciple which testifieth of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. So it's talking about it's John there. Says, look, John wrote these things. He's the one bearing witness, and we know that John is trustworthy because he was there. He was an eyewitness. He was there when all this stuff was said. He was there when all this was done. You can't get a better source. He's a first-hand source. Not that they're praising him as a historical source. They're just saying, look, John wrote this. John can be trusted. Verse 25. And there are also many other things which Jesus did, the which, if they should be written every one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written. Amen. I like how John ends it, not by saying, wow, I sure hit a home run with this book. I'm glad I wrote this, because this really is the end-all story about Christ's ministry. No, he didn't. He ends it by saying, boy, I tried the best I could, but you really cannot write it all down. Now, you think about it, a 3.5 or so year ministry that Christ had on earth, why couldn't they write it all down? Well, I'm sure, you know, they could have kept a list. Well, you know, he was in Bethlehem and he healed a lame man there at 5:06 p.m. And then he was in Bethany. And oh, yes, that's where he healed two blind men and one leper, and you know, one's name was Simon and one's name was Barabbas, and you know, that level of detail. Yeah, I guess, you know, it could be written. But I think also what you can take from this is not just the depth of Christ's ministry here on earth, that it was just inexhaustible, that there's so much detail and so much that he did that you just cannot comprehend or even record the many facets of it. But I think it also goes to show that Christ's work is not done. Christ is still at work today, because his ministry did not end with the closing of the Gospels. Far from it, because his ministry brought salvation to mankind. And that's still being carried out today. The ministry of Christ is still going on right now. And lives are still being changed. Souls are still being saved. The lost are still being reached. That is the ministry of Christ. It's still going on. And you want to talk about not being able to write down the many facets of a ministry? Think about one that's been going on for 2,000 years now. Think of the lives that have been touched. Think about the people that have changed. Think about the destinies, the eternities that have been changed. Just think about the impact that Christ had on this world. In fact, I'm not sure, there's very few people that impacted the world, even from a practical standpoint, as much as Christ. You could say Alexander the Great did. You could say Julius Caesar did. There's Caesar Augustus did to an extent. But you want to talk about changing the world to even the point that we date our time by his birth, AD and BC. That's how important his coming was, because he was the Son of God. He came to bring salvation to mankind. Well, with that, we've about 30 seconds past the hour mark. I think this go down is not, if not the longest lesson, it's going to be one of the closest. And I guess that's fitting to wrap up the longest project I have undertaken for the website. I hope that you have enjoyed this. Stay tuned to the website. I hope to be starting a new series soon. I haven't decided exactly which way to go. Probably will not be another study going through a book of the Bible. Probably be something a little more topical, but just for a change of pace. But this definitely will not be the last one of these I do. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you. Hope that you have learned something. Hope this challenged you. As I say, stay tuned to the website. Just keep checking back, www.baptistbasics.org. And keep up with the news there. Might check out some of the other courses at the Baptist Basics University section. And keep track of us on iTunes and the RSS news feed that's out there, all the many ways. And if this has been a help and a blessing to you, I'd appreciate hearing from you. You can send me an email. Email's at the website, or you can email me at webmaster@baptistbasics.org. And I do my best to answer those emails. So I greatly appreciate your time sticking with me. As I say, I'm pretty sure we will have gone over 24 hours of total audio through the book of John. I appreciate you sticking with me, and hope I've been helping to bless you. I keep saying that, but I just, that's why I'm doing this. I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this to help everybody out there. So thanks for listening, and we'll draw this to a close.